Turn that guitar up.
Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock albums. I'm Redbeard, and today, in the studio, it's the 5th anniversary of the late George Harrison's comeback, Cloud Nine.
You know, I just liked the idea of the ELO. There was a part of it that annoyed me, but I really secretly loved it because it carried on, in a way, the Beatle thing, and it fused it into the old rock and roll. And Jeff has got the skill of having all these little bits, you know, nice little bits all strung together. And so I was aware of him for a long time, but I never knew him, I never met him until during the years, you know, while I was Howard Hughes.
I got my mind set on you. Got my mind set on you. Long time ago when we was fab.
In the studio, I'm George Harrison with Redbeard.
You know, to be honest, George Harrison never caught a break after stunning the entire music world with his post-Beatle triple album All Things Must Pass in 1970. When the single My Sweet Lord went to number one worldwide, George was sued for inadvertently plagiarizing the song. When George Harrison responded, however, naively to a plea by Ravi Shankar to help starving people in Bangladesh, Harrison ended up owing $2.25 million personally in British taxes. When George toured the U.S. in 1974, he was mercilessly criticized by rock critics for tampering with the Beatles' legacy, then sued by his own record company for not delivering another album. By late 1982, George Harrison seemed content to focus on producing films such as Monty Python's The Life of Brian and also Time Bandits, and a disinterested public seemed not to notice his absence. 5 long years would pass before the November 1987 release of the album Cloud Nine, but George Harrison felt satisfied, he told me, with the album's eventual success.
People tend to write you off, and I don't, it's a bit silly, because after all the time we've been around, you know, you'd think, well, I must know something by now. So I always felt confident that if I wanted to do something, you know, and do it right, I could eventually. It's just the desire and building up the desire to do it. So it was very nice for me because people saying, oh, you know, yeah, he's okay. You know, they suddenly gave me the green light, you know. The worst thing is if you make a record and it doesn't get played on the radio, or, you know, nobody gets to know that it's out, or nobody buys it if they do know it's out. That's, because then you got to start again and do it all again. So it's very satisfying to sell records and get good airplay on it. I like to put some words in songs that if anybody out there's listening, you know, that they can, you know, give them a bit of hope too. You know, it's like also saying, you know, don't worry, it's only a bit of time, and if you keep on trucking, you know, it'll be okay.
Have my love, it fits you like a glove. Joy my dream, tell me yes. Bail out should there be a mess. The pieces you don't need are mine. Take my time, I'll show you cloud nine. my smile and my heart, they were yours from the start. Pieces to make a mind. Have my love, use it while it does you good. Share my highs, but the times that he hurts, pain of mind. Those pieces you don't need are mine. I'll see you there on cloud nine.
The song and Cloud Nine album were produced by former Electric Light Orchestra leader and unabashed Beatle fan Jeff Lynne. I asked George Harrison about befriending Jeff.
It was fun doing Cloud Nine. You know, as I say, the new songs, you know, because they're changing over the years, you know. I mean, if I could still write Here Comes the Sun, I would gladly do it. But my songs are changing a bit. You know, I just like the idea of the yellow. There was a part of it that annoyed me, but I really secretly loved it because it carried on, in a way, the Beatle thing, and it fused it into the old rock and roll. And Jeff has got the skill of having all these little bits, you know, nice little bits all strung together. And so I was aware of him for a long time, but I never knew him, I never met him until during the years, you know, while I was Howard Hughes. I think it's apart from the music, you see, Beatles came from the north of England, and Jeff came from this place just down the road, a heavy industrial area of the middle of England, Birmingham. You know, our life, upbringing as kids, and the kind of music you heard, and, you know, all that, that's all part of it. It's all the way he drinks a pint of beer or something. You know, it's things like that. I think, first of all, and just the kind of people we are, and then the music, you know, because that's what I always felt. I'd never really written tunes with other people. I mean, I'd done a bit with Ringo, you know, helped him with songs, but I was very scared about writing songs with other people because it's not easy. Sometimes it's easy, and sometimes, you know, when you're trying to force it out, you know, you can write a lot of rubbish before you get to it. But I always thought with Jeff, well, if we get on as people, the music's going to be easy. And that was the main thing.
I know you're in the sun. I know you're close to everyone. At times it's like you don't have a hold on. I see you in love. I see you in love. like the wind, you don't let me see. You know I feel the pain.
You know I feel the pain.
I'm tired of playing games with you. Though there's nothing else I want that would set me free. But I wanna know for sure that you let me see.
Fish on the Sand from George Harrison's Cloud 9 album has a very distinctive guitar, with George encouraged by producer Jeff Lynne to play the 12-string Rickenbacker guitar as George had done with the Beatles.
How did you get that bell-like, that jangly guitar sound originally?
Originally, it was a Rickenbacker 12-string. It was before that which inspired the Byrds was A Hard Day's Night. Some of the songs stuff. On that were where I first played the Rickenbacker. Mm. And then Roger McGuinn, he got the Rickenbacker. And then he was doing a Tambourine Man and all that. And that song was inspired by one on their first album, which was called The Bells of Rimini. Mm-hmm. And then I wrote that, you know, just to see how many tunes you can come up with that same D shape, you know, basic D chord on the guitar. So many songs written around there. I used it on A Hard Day's Night, and I Should Have Known Better, and I think Norwegian Wood was an acoustic 12-string. Well, it was on a few tracks, but I think the one that really stands out in my mind as the greatest one is Tambourine Man by the Byrds.
In a tribute, Rolling Stone magazine editor Joe Levy said, and I quote, "Harrison made it clear he didn't need fame. He often said that his ego was satisfied. That's an extremely rare thing for a rock star. They usually get what they want and then want it over and over again. But that's not who George was."
You know, when you're young, you're out there trying to make a name for yourself or just trying to make a living or an occupation. And, you know, ego is necessary. You have to have it. But we went through so much. You know, we were put on such a pedestal, and we had everybody, the whole world was sort of bowing and scraping to us, and the press following us around every day. We were on the front page of all the papers for, you know, a couple of years. It seemed like a long time. And what happens in that condition, I think anybody who has any sense, you realize that there's more to life than this. The book, which is the Hindu Bible, is called the Bhagavad Gita. And I don't know if you recall an album I had out called Living in the Material World.
Sure.
Inside of that, there was a picture of Krishna and Arjuna on a chariot. What the Bhagavad Gita is all about is that the battlefield and the chariot and the horses, you see, life is the battlefield. We're in our bodies which is the chariot, on this battlefield, and the horses are all the senses which are pulling us through the battlefield. And unless we have God or something that, you know, whatever you want to call it, to anchor yourself or to help you get through the battlefield, you're just going to crash. You know, all the experience we gain, sometimes you go through terrible things, but they actually turn out to be good because they help you rise above it. So it's all a learning process. I mean, I think life is just like, you know, going to school, and you have to figure it out, learn certain things, and hopefully rise above it.
Could you have written When We Was Fab in 1974?
No. I wouldn't have thought about it. I would have been too hung up on the past, you know, the Beatles. But now it's like it's good that you could look back at it with just think of the funny stuff. We just knocked it out on the piano one night and somebody put a cassette on, so we just taped all the whatever we were doing. We got a bit legless and this kept giving us bottles of champagne in this person's house. And yeah, and then we went back to England and finished it off, and we had Ringo plays drums, as you can hear him on the beginning. Yeah. One, two, that. In fact, that's how I conceived the song. I was thinking of Ringo just doing that. One, two, ba-ba-da, ba-ba-da, boom.
Back then, long time ago, when grass was green, woke up in a daze, arrived like strangers in the night. Fab. Long time ago when we was fab. Fab. Back when income tax was all we had. Caresses fleeced you in the morning light. Casualties at dawn. And we did it all. Long time ago when we was fab. In my world you are my only love. Scopes that magnified the tears studied warts and arm. Still the life flowed on and on. Long time ago when we was fab. But it's all over now, baby. Blue.
A loving tribute to his mates in the Beatles comes with George Harrison on the Cloud 9 album called When We Was Fam. Up next, we'll tune into the gossip on the Devil's Radio and then learn how George's number one hit from this album almost got left off. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and hear a lot more from George Harrison, Paul McCartney, and the Beatles at inthestudio.net. I'm Red Beard, in the studio for the anniversary of George Harrison's big comeback album, Cloud 9.
Welcome back in the studio. I'm George Harrison with Red Beard.
Of course, that's the late George Harrison. He's missed dearly. I'm Red Beard. Americans have only recently become aware of the merciless and pervasive nature of certain scandalous elements of the British press. But George Harrison endured it from 1964 with the Beatlemania until the day he died. George coined the title Devil's Radio for the vicious gossip.
After that 74 tour, I got such a slagging off in the newspapers or in the magazines. You know, it's like they smell blood and they try and come in for the kill. They try to kill you and then they try and nail the coffin down, the lid, you know, so you never get out again. And I felt that kind of thing happened during the end of 74 into 75.
The devil's radio.
Gossip.
Oh yeah.
Proving without a doubt that life is a circle rather than a straight line, George Harrison provided the historical background to the choice of cover song, I've Got My Mind Set on You.
Did you ever see that old film of the Beatles in New York in 1964 that Maisel's made? It's been around for years, and there's scenes of us coming into New York City, and there's a scene in the Plaza Hotel and Murray the K's there. Yeah. During that, we're on the telephone to Murray the K's station, and he's asking us for requests. And you can see in that film, I say, have you got a record called Got My Mind Set on You by James Ray? And it's that song has just been with me in the back of my head for years. And as it happened, when we were doing those sessions, Keltner had got this drum pattern. He was like in one corner just making up all this crazy drum patterns. And he got this thing that was really swinging, you know, rock and swing both together. Mm-hmm. And Gary Wright was there. And Gary turned around and said, hey, doesn't that remind you of Got My Mind Set on You? And I said, absolutely, because I'd played that song to myself over the years thinking, God, this song is so good, because as a pop or rock song, because it's got all the best bits, got like twist and shout and, you know, it's got all the good chords, you know. And so I said, absolutely, and we just did it there and then. Well, you know, that was the one track we weren't really going to have on the album. And then we thought, well, it really is good. It's a good track. We should have it on the album. And then, of course, I brought the album to Warner's, and Lenny listened and listened and listened, and he said, that's the single. I think his daughter picked it. And he was so right. Also, my boy, while we were recording it, he kept saying, that's the single.
I got my mind set on you. I got my mind set on you. I got my mind set on you. Got my mind set on you. But it's gonna take a minute.
Originally a mid-60s favorite by James Ray, that's George Harrison's Cloud 9 version that went to number one by January 1988, propelling the Cloud 9 album to the number 8 slot. Still to come, George tells how superstardom so early in life as a Beatle may have actually inhibited his growth as a musician, and also alludes to the habit that would later contribute to his early demise. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and hear a whole lot more at inthestudio.net. I'm Red Beard, and you're in the studio for the anniversary of George Harrison's comeback album, Cloud Nine.
Welcome back in the studio. I'm George Harrison with Red Beard.
As we continue to mourn the passing of George Harrison in November 2001, we nevertheless celebrate his remarkable comeback, Cloud Nine. One of the most surprising things George Harrison ever shared with me is how Beatlemania actually stunted George from evolving as a musician.
Have you ever envied the journeyman musician who could be in and would be in a number of bands over the course of a career?
Well, I think we all go through our lives and we must do what we must do, you know, and it's like my life, instead of being in a working band, like we started out, I was starting to get good as a musician and then I got diverted into being a pop star, you know, so I I lost out as far as being a musician goes, whereas, say, Eric, who went, well, as soon as he was becoming a pop star, he joined another band and he just kept going.
I
really would have liked in some part of me to have been able to do that. So at this point in my life, I would be a better guitar player. I'd be more fluent.
And your old songs wouldn't be new.
Yeah, that's the danger. Well, you know, we all have the ups and downs of our individual lives and we must do what we must do. So, you know, I'm quite happy as what happened because, you know, the result of it is that I, you know, what I am now is I wouldn't be this if I'd have being that, you know, it's as simple as that. And I'm quite happy with my lot.
Precious words drift away from the meaning, and the sun melts the chill from our lives, helping us all to remember what we came here for. This is love. This is la 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 love. This is love.
we find out the kind of the lighter side to George Harrison, almost silly, and I mean that in a
very silly,
in a complimentary.
I've always been very silly, really.
But we didn't really see a whole lot of that.
No, because there was a period. If I just through that period of the '60s when we all went to Rishikesh looking for the light, that side it got a bit serious, you know. And the thing is, if I don't crack a smile, my face just looks serious anyway. And I think a lot of my songs were, you know, had funny little things in them, but because I wasn't smiling, people didn't take them as a joke. And I think what they did was they pigeonhole me into this thing of, oh, he's the mystical one, the spiritual one, or he's the boring one, or whatever. And consequently, they missed out on some of the jokes that I was putting in there.
Had his health permitted, George would have looked forward to the more genteel live audiences here in the 21st century.
I would like to now, yeah, because the time I did that tour in the States also, it was a very difficult period because the audiences were like wacko, you know. They were like, they were drunk and disorderly. And I was thinking, you know, most of these people, half of them may come to see you and the other half come because that's what's happening
it's
in town, or they're with somebody who's come to see you.
It's a scene.
And I kept thinking, well, maybe it's better just to play to like 200 people who actually like you than, you know, 17,000 people who are just going somewhere to get loaded. And nowadays, I think everybody's matured. We're all older, and the audience may be old. All those. I think it's a much better time. You know, for me, I can control myself. I'm a bit more grown up, and I approach it from a much more professional point of view. I can't make decisions. I'm very bad at doing decisions, and I have to just wait and see what will be. I didn't really know how my physical body could stand up to it because I'm not an athletic kind of person. You know, some people are always out there playing tennis and jogging, and like Mick Jagger for a tour. Mick, you know, he jogs backwards for like, you know, 20 miles every day. So, and he does that on stage, running
yes,
up
does.
And down that and scaffolding.
Yes, he does.
So I'm not like that. All I do is stand there. And sometimes it's taken me, over the last few years, it's taken me, you know, all my strength just to sit on the couch watching TV. It's, you know, I'm not the most physical person. So I needed to get myself together, you know, so that I didn't want to, like, collapse on stage halfway through.
No,
the night.
That wouldn't
look good. So this story is getting a bit old now, but I stopped smoking. You know, I used the tour as an excuse to get rid of this horrible curse of nicotine. So it worked. I thought, now if I'm going to do this, I got to try, you know, because Eric was so generous. I thought the least I can do is try to do it as good as I can and maybe make him proud, you know, to have been a part of it or the instigator behind this. You know, I didn't want to just, like, flunk out. So stopped smoking, and I tried to get some breathing exercises so I could sing and have a bit more power to my voice. And once I get going, you know, I feel really good.
Is it easier now than, say, 5 years after Beatles?
Oh, it's much easier now.
Why?
Just because, you know, the water under the bridge is good. You know, time heals everything and put a bit of distance between, you know, now I can just take it, or like all these songs I'm doing, I can just enjoy it. I can just enjoy it for what it is. I'm more mature. I'm happier. I think I'm healthier.
You seem always.
Yeah,
right?
And so I'm determined to be able to each day just try to enjoy it. And you know, that's what it's about, really. It's just about how to get blissed out. And if there's, you know, any chance that I'm going to be in a negative situation or in something that's painful, then I don't want to do that. I just want to be happy. Every album I've ever made, I write the tune, I record it, and that's it. I listen to it during the mixing and maybe up until the point where, you know, it's been out for a week or so, and then that's it.
But do you agree that that's definitely not the norm for most musicians?
Most of them are working bands, and they just go in, record, like we used to do in the early 60s. You make an album, and off you go on the road.
Just for today, I could try to live through this day only, not deal with all life's problems just for today.
George Harrison, with the heartfelt Just For Today from Cloud 9. Walk forever in the light, my friend. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my dearly departed guest, George Harrison. God rest his soul. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2017, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online 24/7 at inthestudio.net.